Thank you, friends, and thank you, Sunera, for those very kind words. I'm very happy to meet you at last because I'd heard of you after 9/11 for the courageous and brave words which you spoke in those scoundrel times when dissent was silenced. And we'd not met, but I felt very close to you when I heard what you'd said and the obloquies that had been heaped on your head by those in power and media campaigns, etc., when people don't like hearing the truth. So let me start tonight with 9/11, which is virtually almost forgotten. That was the start of the so-called war against terror, against Al-Qaeda, against Osama bin Laden. Today it's a totally different war. I don't think the networks have mentioned Osama bin Laden or Al-Qaeda for many, many weeks now. And when that war in Afghanistan started, when they decided to go and wage a war of revenge and bomb Afghanistan, some of us felt and said in public that this was not going to get them anywhere. Because when the great thinker president of the United States announces publicly that the aim of this war is the capture of Osama bin Laden, dead or alive, to imagine that Osama bin Laden is going to wait for him in the Bora Bora caves and prepare pots of tea to welcome Americans when they get there, you have to be really stupid to believe that. And the entire American strategy of trying to capture the Al-Qaeda leadership failed because it was bound to fail. These are not people tied to any state. So having failed to capture Osama bin Laden, they then went for the head of the Taliban, Mullah Omar. Now this is a one-eyed, bearded cleric, badly wounded in one arm, walks with a limp. They say they have the most amazing surveillance techniques in the world. They couldn't even capture him. When last seen by American journalists and other Western journalists, he was reported to be on a motor bicycle heading in the direction of the sunset, like Steve McQueen in The Great Escape. So they didn't capture him either. Then they thought they would win a big victory, and there was no victory because the Taliban refused to fight, because the Pakistan army, which controls the bulk of the Taliban, told them not to fight and to shave their beards off and get out of the country as soon as possible. And the virtue being preached at that point was patience. Let the Americans come and bomb the country, set up a quisling puppet government. They will get tired and go away. It's a poor country, and then we'll be back. And that's exactly, incidentally, what is beginning to take place now in Afghanistan. Exactly what is beginning to happen. So the war in Afghanistan was a disaster. The other great war which they fought was the 73-day bombing campaign against Yugoslavia. A war which was unnecessary, since Milosevic had agreed to pull the troops out of Kosovo anyway and let the United Nations or whatever cover the Americans wanted go in and control that place. But Madeleine Albright, remember her? Yeah. She decided that she wanted to bomb Yugoslavia, and she told the Albanian delegation there, don't you act as an obstruction, otherwise we won't bomb Yugoslavia. So she put in into the clause of the deal which had already been agreed, unacceptable conditions which no self-respecting government could accept. And still, they didn't get a fight. They bombed Yugoslavia, but the Yugoslav army emerged unscathed after weeks of bombing. They didn't fight because the Russians told them not to fight. So the Pakistanis told the Taliban not to fight. The Russians told the Yugoslavs not to fight. So those were easy victories. And when they went into Iraq, because they had had an easy success in both Yugoslavia and Afghanistan, they assumed that that pattern would repeat itself. And the media supporting them, both the embedded journalists and the non-embedded journalists, they also thought this would be a cakewalk. The Iraqi Quislings, in the pay of the American intelligence agencies for the last 30 years, went to see the American president and told him to encourage him to speed up the attack. You will be welcomed when you arrive in Iraq by the population with sweets and flowers. And that they will have mass insurrections against Saddam. No one will resist. That is what they went hoping for. And they got the exact opposite. They got the exact opposite. Large numbers of ordinary people interviewed in the international press said, we may not like Saddam, but we hate these people even more. And it's normal. When you set out to occupy a country, you have to be very stupid to imagine that people there are going to welcome being bombed, killed, their country taken over, tanks surrounding them, water supplies cut off, even if the regime in that country is not popular. So it didn't happen. The welcome didn't happen. And in two or three cities, it became clear that large gatherings of the population were opposed to this war. So we are now in week five. And while American soldiers sprawl in the presidential palaces in Baghdad in the most disgusting imperial fashion, and an American colonel tells the media, now we own it all, which is the headline of the LA Times yesterday, there are still battles going on in parts of Baghdad. That is the situation we confront today. Now, given American military power, given the total bankruptcy, political and economic, of the Arab regimes in that area, who have not been able to resist at all. It's almost as if the only function of the Arab Union is to meet and paint the black stone of the Kaaba in the red and blue colors of the American flag. They've done nothing. An Arab country has been occupied. Openly, in public view, the Egyptians have let these equipment and weapons move through the Suez Canal. No charge, free, gratis. We don't want the money. The Saudi Arabians have allowed all the bases there to be used. The little Gulf statelets run by rulers appointed by an older imperialism have made their countries available. Kuwait, plucky little Kuwait, remember? 10 years ago, plucky little Kuwait, which was going to get democracy. Well, plucky little Kuwait is today an American military base, with no Kuwaiti citizens allowed near the base because they are scared. That's the situation we confront. And Iraq, a country on which more misery has been heaped by the West than any single country since the Second World War, with the exception of Vietnam, sanctions imposed for 15 years, which have wrecked that country's social infrastructure, led to the deaths of millions of, half a million children. The depleted uranium used in the first Gulf War is still producing cancers in the wombs of pregnant women. And a weekly bombing raids by the Anglo-American air cavalry for the last 12 years. They've now leave this war alone. In the previous 12 years, they dropped more bombs on Iraq than were dropped on Vietnam throughout the Vietnam War. And then they expect people there to love them. Just imagine. And now we have a new development, because there hasn't been welcoming with sweets and flowers. The journalists, tame journalists in the Western media, are saying that there is something wrong with the Iraqi people because they didn't welcome us. They are sick. I'm not joking. I want to read this out to you because it's the sign of the mentality which is currently around. This is the George Mellon in the Wall Street Journal. After 3 decades of rule of the Arab equivalent of Murder, Inc., Iraq is a very sick society. To develop an orderly society and privatize the economy will take time. On the front page of the Sunday Times, a Murdoch paper, its reporter Mark Franchetti quotes an American NCO, a Marine, in Iraq. This is what the Marine says to him. The Iraqis are a sick people and we are the chemotherapy, said Corporal Ryan Dupre. I'm starting to hate this country. Wait till I get hold of a frigging Iraqi. No, I won't get hold of one, I'll just kill him. This report in Murdoch's flagship paper goes on to describe how the unit killed not one but several Iraqi civilians that day. And no doubt the Sikh society theory will acquire greater sophistication. But it's clear that all these pretexts are on hand for a mixture of Guantanamo and Gaza in these newly occupied territories. This is what's going on. And as for democracy, at the time of the first Gulf War, this is what Colin Powell, currently Secretary of State, at that time the senior general in command of the war back in Washington, this is what he said then. Saddam Hussein is a terrible person, he's a threat to his own people. I think his people would be better off with a different leader, but there is this sort of romantic notion that if Saddam got hit by a bus tomorrow, some Jeffersonian Democrat is waiting in the wings to hold popular elections. Brackets, laughter. This is American journalists laughing at this great joke. What you're going to get, guess what? Probably another Saddam Hussein. It'll take a little while for them to paint the pictures all over the walls again. Brackets, laughter. But there should be no illusions about the nature of that country or its society. And the American people and all of the people who second-guess us now would have been outraged if we'd gone on to Baghdad and we found ourselves in Baghdad with American soldiers patrolling the streets 2 years later, still looking for Jefferson. Laughter. This time, the Jeffersonian Democrats, Iraqi Quislings, are being flown in with the air conditioning and the rest of the supplies and being put in power. And they will have to be guarded night and day by squads of hired American goons, just like the puppet Karzai installed in Kabul. That is the only possibility for Iraq now. So we are at a very critical time in global, in world history. And this war in Iraq is a war which will mark one of the most formative events of the 21st century. Have no doubt about that. That's how important this invasion is, an occupation. And it is this instinctive recognition by millions of people all over the world that this is something new, that this new imperial offensive was designed by Bush and his team to show how they intend to dominate the world and crush any opposition, that brought so many people out onto the streets to try and stop the war. Because the millions who came out, in most cases, were people who had never been on demonstrations before. They felt deep inside this war was wrong, and they were right. Their instincts were absolutely correct on this. And many of them, who have not been engaged in politics before, also tended to get demoralized when they found they couldn't stop the war. But if they'd stopped to think, they would have known that it was virtually impossible to stop this war, short of a rebellion inside the United States or an Arab-wide intifada which swept the Arab world. Short of that, it was difficult to stop this war. Even Bush's favorite European politician, not a poodle, but a bloodhound, Tony Blair, who the minute he smells blood starts barking. Even he wasn't considered necessary for this war. At one stage, Rumsfeld said, if you're having trouble with your parliament, don't come. We don't need your 30,000 troops. We can do it ourselves. So they were determined to take Iraq. And it was not for any one reason, but for a mixture of reasons. And all these reasons point out to what the needs of this empire now are. First and foremost, Iraq was an Arab country in an oil-rich region. And you know, I say this, that many people feel that Islam is under attack. I really don't think that's the case. It so happens that a large bulk of the world's oil lies underneath lands that are Islamic. If the people who were living in these countries were Buddhists, Buddhism would be under attack. If the whole of Africa was Muslim and there were no Muslims anywhere else, they would never be under attack. So why this region is under attack has not got much to do with religion. It has got everything to do with imperial power, imperial economics, imperial needs. And they want to dominate this world because energy is going to be crucial in this century, even more than it was in the last one. But they could have controlled the oil by doing a deal with the Iraqi regime as they had done before. But they felt this was not sufficient for two other reasons. One reason, which people, especially in North America, don't like concentrating on too much, but which I insist is very crucial, is that the United States leadership at the moment, a very audacious imperial leadership, the model for this leadership, even in terms of building the Republican Party, is the model supplied by the Likud party in Israel. And these American Likudists were very keen to help their friends in Israel, who have been obsessed by Iraq for long, long years, because they felt that Iraq was the only country with the capacity and the possibility of challenging their hegemony over the region and over Palestine unless it was stopped. And the Israelis were very angry that Baghdad wasn't occupied in 1990-91. And they've been under heavy pressure. So the occupation of Iraq becomes a strategic, geopolitical, military priority for the Middle East. And the third reason is an old reason, which all empires utilize, that they often use force and awe, as they now call it, to show the rest of the world how powerful they are, as a warning to the rest of the world. Look what we did to Baghdad. You be careful. If you misbehave, the same could happen to you. And this force and awe was first used in Japan, just as the Second World War was coming to an end. What was the nuclear assault on Hiroshima and Nagasaki? The war had already been won. The Japanese were on the verge of surrender. Why destroy two of their cities with nuclear weapons? It was a demonstration for the Soviet Union and a demonstration to the world, which was then in upheaval and in revolution, saying this is what we've got and this is what we can do. And the occupation of Iraq today is a demonstration both to that region, to the Syrians, to the Iranians, and it's a demonstration to the countries in the Far East, to China, who they are completely obsessed with. Because China is the only country in the world today whose economy is developing very, very rapidly. Shanghai is probably the most dynamic capitalist city in the world. And within 10 years, it's not impossible they could overtake the United States economically. And so the United States think tanks do nothing else but prepare game plans on China. What happens if China does A, B, C? Could we balkanize China? How do we do that? Do we do it using India? Do we do it via Tibet? Do we provoke a conflict with Taiwan and then move in? And that's how they think.